Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never got home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
It was around this time last year that we had a chat on the Irish Times Second Captain's podcast about post-prime Roger Federer. You get serious second captain's kudos if you can recall any of this obscure conversation. Let me refresh your memories, Murph and Ken.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go on.
It was sparked by a piece Bill Simmons had done with Malcolm Gladwell, in which they argued that sports fans are coming to appreciate longevity a lot more when weighing up the parameters in these greatest of all time conversations. But if you can continue to do it for as long as possible, even when you're past your best, you should get some bonus points for that. In the case of Federer, I had a closer look. I chose 2009 as the end of his true peak years. It was the last year that he won more than one Grand Slam title in the same 12 months. Okay. So in the 6 years from 2010, the post-prime period, he won two Grand Slams, or he had won two Grand Slams, had come runner-up four times, and had made eight further semi-finals, that is. In other words, Roger Federer on the downslide had had a significantly better career than the vast majority of people who ever played his sport. But the last of those titles was 2012. I think most of us long for just one more. Mm. Now in his post-prime, he has landed another major title. The Australian Open. Post-prime Federer, Ken, took care of post-prime Rafa.
Yeah.
Is post-prime a double negative, though? Do you now contend that he's back in his prime?
No.
No, I mean, even further post, on. Yeah.
Post doesn't mean, like, positive, isn't it? Doesn't have a positive or negative. It just has a temporal.
I suppose I'm just describing negative connotations.
Just means after post-prime.
Okay.
So after the prime.
Okay.
Almost subprime.
But no, I mean, if you're after something, aren't you just after it then? You know? Shouldn't it just be post-prime?
So as I said, post-prime Roger Federer takes care of post-prime Rafael Nadal. You were happy, Murphy. You wanted, on Friday, you were hoping that baby Fed would come up against adult post-prime Fed.
Yes.
But in the end, it was his old rival Nadal.
Pre-prime Dimitrov.
Now that Federer has actually beaten Nadal.
Yeah.
Are you happy that it was Nadal who got through to face him?
Yeah.
I know you're really not a Nadal man. It's just,
no,
it's not,
no,
it's not for you.
No, he's not. He's not for me. he's not for me, Owen. I would not be a big Rafael Nadal fan, but that's fine. I think you're splitting hairs, really, aren't you? I mean, everyone just wanted Roger Federer to win one of these. So whoever he beat in the final doesn't really make.
It makes a bit of a difference. It makes a bit of a difference that it was the guy who's had a hold on him over the years. The world's biggest Roger Federer fan, Simon, is nodding in agreement.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, well, listen, if you're asking me to retrospectively support Rafael Nadal in his game against Grigor Dimitrov on Friday, well,
consider
I'm sorry, it's not going to happen.
I always preferred Nadal, actually, because for Federer, it always seemed to me as though it was just a bit too easy for him. He's like Mr. Perfect. Oh, Mr. Perfect, Roger Federer with his white Nike blazer. Honestly, the most ludicrous piece of sporting apparel I've ever seen.
You got to let that one go at some stage.
Hmm?
You just got to let the blazer go at some point.
I know. I haven't seen it in a while, but, you know.
He did practice his many hours to get to where he was. He didn't just get handed a blazer once he arrived at Wimbledon.
He was Mr. Perfect. Like, he's just Mr. Perfect in every way. Even his hair was perfect.
Still just about hanging on as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, poor old Nadal, by contrast, is looking weather beaten, you know, worn down by the years. And he's still only, what is he? We were talking to the 30.
Yeah.
But, you know, whereas Nadal was kind of never quite as talented, never, but kind of just through sheer force of will. You know, he was like a kind of angrier player, like an angrier presence on the court, like more, come on, he really wanted. I was kind of admiring him. And then something put me off him, which of course isn't really his fault. But, you know, it's difficult to look at him the same way, thanks to the Spanish judges and what they did with the Fuentes case.
Mm.
I'm afraid that the cost of the Fuentes situation, all those blood bags sitting around and ordered to be destroyed,
means you don't believe in your Spanish athletes anymore.
Well, it just, this is the problem. This is the problem when you do that. You know, Rafael Nadal has never been implicated in anything like that. But when you do that,
the best case scenario for Rafael Nadal is that he's an innocent victim of innuendo swirling around, which is
it casts a bit of a pall. You know, it's like, right, well, this happened, and all of the Spanish athletes have to deal with they become victims of the lack of transparency. They're overshadowed a little bit by this. By this thing that happened, whether or not they should be, that's the way it is.
Mm.
So I kind of come around a little bit to Federer, and I kind of respect that he. I mean, well, it's the argument that you're saying. I kind of respect that still at 35, he's still Mr. Perfect, and
his perfection has become charming again. It's gone on for so long
because it's not. Yeah, it's not easy to keep it going for as long as he has. You know, he's. I respect him.
Well, I imagine you'd have the. I'm sure he'd be delighted to hear that, Ken. I'm sure you would also have a lot of respect for Serena, who's post prime. Well, in those years, in those same years since 2009, well, from 2010, she's the same age as Federer. So it's fair in some ways to make this comparison. She's won 12 Grand Slam titles,
which also constitutes a pretty good career.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Many tennis players would be happy with that career.
Just the 12. We'll take 12 Grand Slams. Yeah. We're going to get stuck into the tennis chat in a bit. We'll also get over to Dave Hannigan in the US as the sports world rounds on President Trump after the ban on immigrants from 7 countries came into effect. Well, at least one or two members of the sports world have rounded on Trump. Mo Farah, you know, your side's comment, the Queen made me a knight, Donald Trump made me an alien. He's now okay. They've double checked it, and Farah's actually all right to travel. So his people say that he is relieved, but he still stands by his criticisms of the plan. And USA soccer captain Michael Bradley, most notably, he had chatted to Grant Wall in Sports Illustrated. Just to give you the background, and so this is where this statement comes from. A few hours ago, I gave an interview to Grant Wall, says Bradley. After 15 minutes of an interview that was centered around soccer and our national team, he asked me my thoughts on President Trump's ban on Muslims. I gave an answer where I tried to make it clear that while I understand the need for safety, the values and ideals of our country should never be sacrificed. Now, sometimes when you hear a sports person say this, they're about to hammer the journalist for misrepresenting them in some way, or they didn't say what was put down there. You know, in this case, he says, I believe what I said, but it was too soft. The part I left out is how sad and embarrassed I am. When Trump was elected, I only hoped that President Trump would be different than the campaigner Trump, that the xenophobic, misogynistic and narcissistic rhetoric would be replaced with a more humble and measured approach to leading our country. I was wrong, and the Muslim ban is just the latest example of someone who couldn't be more out of touch with our country and the right way to move forward. I was just quite impressed with that idea that he hadn't necessarily planned on saying anything, but it came out in an interview. He gave an honest answer and then thought, well, it was an honest answer. It wasn't quite honest enough. And then he actually clarified and went a hell of a lot further than most sports people have done up to this point.
Yeah. No, it is brave. I mean, it's difficult to do that. You got to, you know, if you're a public figure, to actually speak up against the president is quite a big deal.
When he bumps into people in the street, Trump supporters, he's got a lot of annoying conversations to have.
Maybe they're
enlightening conversations for both parties. Who knows?
The Major League Soccer.
yeah, that's
sure
probably,
those conversations
yeah,
that's will go well.
Yeah.
The Major League Soccer fan base may skew blue a little blue, but you know, I'm sure it's not all that way. And you got to admire a man who's willing to stick with his principles.
In case. I was actually about to start reading the email. Got to play the bet first.
I've got a call here. It says, you're the most boring, predictable, condescending interviewer around. Go back to lecturing. You have the charisma of a sick bag.
Oh God.
That's just it. I just mentioned, not you, no me.
Okay, ain't nobody f***ing with my click, 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 click. Ain't nobody fresher than my mom.
We don't normally broadcast all the stuff that comes from scum around the country.
Mark Cole describes himself as a scumbag from the States. In case no one has bothered to send annotations regarding the wrestling poster Owen received in the post last week, some notes for you. Funny enough, nobody had up until this point, Mark. This is the poster that featured quite a bit of political incorrectness. You remember the likes of Lord Littlebrook competing in a midget tag team match.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. That show, 20th of February 1978, featured a world title change as the babyface challenger Bob Backlund defeated the evil champion, superstar Billy Graham. Graham is often credited, in inverted commas, with bringing steroids into wrestling from bodybuilding in the early 1960s. And Graham's theatrical and flamboyant gimmick influences many of those who followed him, including Hulk Hogan and Dusty Rhodes. Mr. Fuji, in brackets Harry Fujiwara, and Professor Toru Tanaka, Charlie Kalani, were both from Hawaii, who became evil Japanese wrestlers in the 1960s and were WWF tag team champions. You may remember Professor Tanaka from his movie career, which included Sub-Zero in Arnold Schwarzenegger's The Running Man. I remember the movie. I can't say I remember it well enough that I can pick out particular characters from it.
Yeah.
Long time since I saw that movie.
Long time.
Yeah.
Wow. It's not one that pops up that often. Like, do you know what I mean? Some movies you just end up seeing it once every 5-10 years. I have not seen that movie.
Total Recall, for instance. Another Arnie staple. So I've seen that loads of times.
Yeah. Even remade recently.
Yeah, well, of course.
Probably not as good a movie.
Our own Colin Farrell was in it, Ken.
Yeah.
I would argue The Running Man probably a better movie than...
Or even the one where he's a cop. The Russian cop. What's that called? Red Heat. I've even seen that a few times. But The Running Man, no.
And Native American hero Chief J. Strongbow was really an Italian from Philadelphia named Joe Scarpa. He was a longtime backstage official with the WWF, inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1994. Way, way more than you probably care to know, I am sure. Well, it is, Mark, but I have now bored our listeners with these. It's just too real. These real names of wrestling characters. Just let them be the characters. Yeah. I don't mind if he's Native American or
Italian. Can't believe Mr. Tanaka and Mr. Fuji, they weren't actually their real names.
Well, Mr. Fuji was close enough. It was Harry Fujiwara.
Yeah, well, it's still not his real name.
Oh. Mr. Fujiwara.
No, his name is Mr. Fuji. And his real name is... forget it.
Incredible weekend of tennis in Melbourne, where Serena Williams and Roger Federer strengthened their claims to be considered among the greatest sports people ever, both of them overcoming long-time rivals. In the case of Serena, that rival just happened to be her big sister. Sinead O'Carroll, news editor of The Journal, is here. How are things, Sinead?
How are you?
Great, thanks. And Elaine Buckley, presenter of the Fair Game podcast, which focuses on women in sport. Elaine, great to have you in.
Thanks, Owen.
I presume you both enjoy the tennis at the weekend. We'll get into it in a second, right after we... I think everybody who watched the women's final in particular was probably taken by the post-match speeches as much as the match itself. We'll hear a little bit of what Venus had to say.
Serena Williams.
That's my little sister, guys. Congratulations, Serena, on number 23. I have been right there with you. Some of them I lost right there against you. I guess that's weird, but it's true. But it's been an awesome thing. Your win has always been my win. I think you know that. And all the times that I couldn't be there, wouldn't be there, didn't get there, you were there.
Venus Williams has just lost a Grand Slam final there, by the way. I know it's to her sister and she's delighted for her sister, but it's pretty incredible to be that together, Elaine, immediately after a match like that.
Yeah, it was as soon as the championship point was won, like Serena dropped to the ground and in an instant Venus was around the other side of the net. First one there she met to help her up and embrace her. Like, it was just absolutely magical moment, I thought.
Their interactions together were... If people watched it right from the start, you would have seen them in the tunnel. I don't think they even acknowledged each other in the tunnel. Now, they might have had breakfast that day. Nobody knows exactly what they do on these mornings. But there was no recognition that we're sisters who deeply love each other. It was all very businesslike right up until, as you say, it just switches at the end of a match.
Yeah, it did. And Venus gave such a brilliant speech afterwards. And like, it was so little about her, all about Serena's achievement. But likewise, when Serena gave her victory speech, she was so complimentary of Venus and the impact that she's had. She said there would be no Williams sisters if it wasn't for Venus paving the way. She said she wouldn't be at 23 without Venus. She certainly even wouldn't be at 1 without Venus. So it was just so humble and just so so reflective of their relationship and their dynamic, I thought.
I think she sees it as a win for herself as well. Like, this anecdote's going back to when they were 9 or 10 and Venus is obviously beating Serena at that early age, being a year older. And Serena asks her during a changeover of a game, "Will you let me win one?" And Venus just ignores her. And so she's probably been teaching her how to be a champion. And then a few years later, Serena tells her coach she's sick of losing. And the only person she's losing to at that stage is Venus. Yeah. So, you know, she's learning from, like, from her big sister. So she's big sister and tennis player all in one, and coach. And
I was going to say that must have been tough enough, because Richard Williams, the father, was quite tough going. And if Venus was that tough on Serena, you can probably see how she was toughened up from an early age.
And seems to be tough on herself as well. I kind of welled up at the sister thing. I have a sister who's 2 years younger than me, who's always been better than me at all sports. So I really kind of looked at her and was like, that's what I, when I see like my little sister do brilliant things, I kind of do that. That's my sister.
A lot of people were saying that afterwards. Yeah, Marion Bartoli, a great player in her time, she was on Eurosport. She said she cried openly at those speeches afterwards. It did seem to, it's very easy to be cynical about quite a lot of top level sport these days, but that did seem to affect people in quite a personal level.
Yeah, I think because they've made such an impact on the sport as well, and that they've done that while still remaining as a family and still having that tight unit, that they haven't let the money or the rivalry or one person being better than the other impact them as well. I think that's touched people.
They were being given huge credit yesterday, Elaine, for how competitive the match was, which wasn't always the case when they played each other in Grand Slam finals. Were they given maybe a bit too much credit for that? You would expect players at that level to be able to put aside almost anything to compete strongly?
Yeah, people have spoken in the past about how Williams finals are somewhat of a letdown, that they're not as competitive as other matchups might be. But I don't really agree. Like yesterday's final, it's almost like they know each other so well that it becomes this really intricate war of attrition. It's like they know what way they're going to serve. They know what way they're going to return. So it becomes a game of millimetres where they really have to choose their shots so precisely in order to win every single point. And I think that showed in yesterday's game, in particular in relation to Serena's serve. Like it's the greatest serve in the game. And she double faulted several times because she has to go for the ace in order to beat Venus. And then when she goes to second serve, Venus is straight away on the attack. Like, you know, she really presses it for that second serve. So I think it's really interesting to watch them.
Maybe it just took them a while to get to that. Sorry, Sinead.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, and I don't want to make this a men's tennis versus women's tennis thing, but I found it for really very early on a pity that it wasn't going to be a best of five, because I thought it took them a while to get into it, and then mind games come in a lot earlier when you go into the second set and you have to stay in it. That's a big mind game for Venus. Then she has to win that set to even still be in the game. So I thought from too early on it felt like it was a done deal once Serena had the first set in the bag, and like at that stage, you know, 6-4, there's only like a couple of shots in the difference, and you're kind of thinking, oh, this is going to be a, you know, two sets and we're done. And it just didn't, I didn't feel like we didn't get enough out of it.
I thought Venus did push her. Like, it was by no means a pushover. Like in that second set, they had the longest rally of the match was on the second last point, which was like she was not giving it up easy.
And Venus won that shot. And I think if there was another, like if something had happened that they had to have go to another set, more moments happen. And I think you had a guy on last week talking about how there's no coaching in tennis and that there are these big swings in momentum.
Luke Jensen, yeah, because I asked him why that's the case, and that was one of his big points, was that you don't get coached. Well, you do sometimes get coached, but you're not supposed to get coached during matches, so it can easily swing twice or three times momentum in one set.
Yeah, so and if you have big points like that and Venus wins it, and you get a little bit of confidence, but if at the back of your mind every game, every point is a must win, then it does kind of influence, I think, a little bit the outcome.
It was such an unusual start to the match as well, like them both breaking each other's serve twice.
Yeah.
A smashed racket in the third game from Serena. Like the stakes were, the pressure was on her, like the stakes were really high, and I think the way it started really, really showed that they were both really up for it.
Disgraceful behaviour. I definitely have never smashed a tennis racket when I played as a teenager. Martin Samuel from the Daily Mail says that Serena should be in the conversation for greatest sports person ever. So she says Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, Usain Bolt, Jack Nicklaus, Pele, Roger Federer, Sir Donald Bradman, Serena Williams, the greatest of all time. There should be no discussion now, no caveats that make a play of gender or wonder how many men she would have beaten. What's your thought on that, Elaine? She's bristled in the past at the idea of being classed as one of the great sports women, because really she's one, should be considered one of the great sports people of all time.
I completely agree. Like she's won the most Grand Slam titles in the Open era, regardless of gender. And she wrote a brilliant, just at the end of last year, she wrote a brilliant open letter to women, kind of, you know, acknowledging what she has achieved herself and calling on women to never settle for being called the greatest women when they've actually achieved more, to just take gender out of it. And it was a really powerful open letter from Serena, and just every woman should read it. It's brilliant.
Is that important? Do you think an important part of it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's her mindset. I think her coach says she never says she's the best. She always says, I don't think I'm at my best yet. And the minute she says she's at her best, she'll be done, because she's always striving. And I think that, like, when she was younger, she used to think that she could beat McEnroe. And like, so that's how we have to think as sports women. I think you don't, like, we're playing different games, and that doesn't mean that she thinks that she can beat every man out there, but she doesn't have to. That's not the game she's playing. So yeah, you should look at yourself as a sports person and be the best sports person.
What sort of an impact has she had in that way, has Serena had, do you think, on how, on maybe changing views of women's sport?
I think Serena and Venus, I'd probably put them together in that. I think, and tennis as well. I think when you look back, say, like our childhoods, probably, like if you think of how many sportswomen you'd even know to emulate, like you're thinking Seles, Graf, Hingis. You're not thinking, there's not that many people outside of tennis and athletics who would have been like big names back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And Venus and Serena just took that to a whole new level then, in terms of what they could do in the face of racism, in the face of sexism, in the face of an absolute insane amount of looking at their bodies and how their bodies looked in terms of like being compared to other tennis players, other women, other sports women.
That's gone on to quite recently. There's an article, I think it was last year, about Serena and her body compared to other female tennis players' bodies.
Yeah, and I think it was being said from when she was like a very, very young child that her body was different to, and that has been scrutinised. And even when they used to bead their hair and how they dressed, everything was talked about like that. So what they have done for women, and in terms of what they've done to make sure that there was equal pay, Venus wrote that letter in 2007 to make sure that Wimbledon was the last of the pay parity, to make sure that they were getting the same money. And actually that struck me as well when Serena was handed the cheque. I think it was $3.8 million. Like, that's unheard of, but that's amazing to go into a class of boys and girls. And you would think that if you asked like a group of 9-year-olds here, how many people want to be a footballer? Probably a load of boys will put up their hand. Mm. Probably not the same for girls, because how, like, it doesn't seem like a viable option for them, or it doesn't seem like a viable career. But if you see a girl winning $3.8 million, you're like, hey, give me a bit of that.
It's interesting, because the tennis is one of the sports where, even, you know, like, I'm 36, even in the 80s watching sport, you were aware of the female tennis players. You've named some of them there. So it possibly led the way in certain ways, in that the some of the top female tennis players got as much attention as some of the male tennis players, but like that, maybe not as much money. And maybe that's what's had to change. Not just the money, but to be seen in an equal footing. This is what the Williams sisters have largely driven over the last 15 years.
Yeah, totally. And last year, Serena was very vocal in the fallout of the CEO of the Indian Wells tournament, making those just appalling statements about equality in tennis and equal money. She was straight out of the blocks, kind of just saying that they're different sports. She has her achievements in her own right, and she works so hard for that money. But I think the thing about Serena, she's become a statistic at this stage. Like, her achievements are just so epic. It's really interesting to look at what she has denied the other great tennis players of her generation. It's like when she won her first Grand Slam, the US Open, in 1999, she beat Clijsters, Seles, Davenport on the way to the final, and beat Hingis in the final. Like, she, if you look comparably at the amount of Grand Slams that they have, I think her nearest is of her generation, Maria Sharapova has 5, Justine Henin has 4, Lindsay Davenport has 3. Like, it's when you look at the other people and how those 23 that she has won have been lost by others, that just makes it all the more impressive.
And no one even took a set off her this time out. Like, it's incredible what she can do.
Are there any drawbacks, though? Some of those names you mentioned, essentially the Williams has ended some of those careers. Some of them never really came back and competed. She possibly hasn't had a great rival in the way that Federer has had Nadal in the men's. Does she suffer for that when you're talking about, if we're talking about this in the highest realm possible and comparing her to the greatest sports people of all time?
Well, like, her closest rival would have been Martina Hingis. I think their record against each other was 7-6 to Serena.
That's a pretty reasonable rivalry.
Pretty reasonable. Compare that with the one which is talked about most often is with Maria Sharapova. That's not a rivalry. Serena is 18-2. Sharapova hasn't beaten her since 2004, when she beat her to win Wimbledon. So I think her dominance is really, really, it's it's just really hammered home when you look at those records.
Yeah, but I think as well that you can talk about the lack of a rival or rivalry or whatever. When you think of Tiger Woods and how brilliant Tiger Woods was as a golfer, in the end, you don't actually think of the tournaments that he won, you know, when he was really challenged. You actually just think about, right, in 2000, he was pretty much unbeatable in a sport where if you win a third of the tournaments you play in, then, you know, you're dominating to an unseen level. I mean, I think at this stage, what you're talking about with Serena, she didn't have a rival because she was just so much better than everyone else, and it's so much better than anyone else we've ever seen. So, I think that maybe while you're in it, like while you're actually watching it, you can think, oh, you know, it would be great to have a rivalry here. If now, looking back now, looking at the numbers, it's like, well, you know, who needs a rivalry? Look at what this woman has done.
And also, it doesn't mean that every single match she plays is easy. I saw her in Wimbledon 2015 against Heather Watson, and Heather Watson was, I think, 2 points away from beating her. And Serena Williams came back. I think she was 3-love down in the third set and came back, and it was, like, it was that overused word, awesome. It was awesome to watch because she was able to pull it out and then keep it together for the last games and win. And she went on to win the tournament. So they're not easy tournaments she's winning. She's beating people along the way that have to be beaten, who are like decent, like brilliant tennis players.
Yeah, and she's been in 29 Grand Slam finals in her career, won 23 obviously, and she's lost 6. The only person she's lost a final twice to is her sister.
Murph, I really thought you were straining to make the nobody beats Maria Sharapova 19 times in a row gag. And
I love that.
You normally don't need an invitation.
I was just about to.
The joyousness of the men's final was staggering. It felt almost like a testimonial, I thought. A testimonial for two great players, one in particular, but which was actually a Grand Slam final. It was kind of a strange occasion in some ways.
Yeah, what a weekend to be in your 30s.
Yes, guys. We were celebrating wildly last
celebrating
week.
In anticipation of it, of the finals, yeah.
There was a figure skater at the European Figure Skating Championships, so I was 37.
Wow, okay.
I'm
not aware of the usual age profile of
about
your...
17.
Okay, right. So
good 20 years older.
That's great going, yeah. Yeah. What did you make of Federer?
God, there's just no words for Federer, are there?
Yeah.
He's just... It was just beautiful to watch.
Funny, that's a word that's used a lot in connection with him. But I kind of thought this weekend and maybe this tournament, people started recognizing belatedly, perhaps, the mental resolve that Federer has shown, that he always shows in matches. Like, we've talked about this before, that he always makes quarterfinals, semifinals, finals, even in the tournaments he wasn't winning. He comes back from this injury. And he's kind of said afterwards, I don't want to complain about it. Everybody has injuries. But, you know, at that age, an injury could often finish you off at the very top level. And then even within the context of the match, the resolve he showed in the final set to come from a breakdown against Rafael Bloody Nadal to win it. It seemed this is the first time that that side of it has been focused on a bit more than just the beauty and the power and the grace of his game.
Yeah, like Federer hasn't been hasn't won a Grand Slam since 2012, and it's only now since he did it yesterday that you realise that you've actually been really missing him, kind of being at the pinnacle, because he's just such a classy sportsman. Like, he's even, again, going to the post match speeches, he was so courteous complimentary towards Nadal, and, you know, telling him that tennis needs you and don't give up. Like, it was, I just...
Too much so, though.
Yeah.
I thought too much so. This thing of, if there was a draw available, I'd come on.
That annoyed me as well, because I'm like, you wanted to beat him, and you talked about learning how to beat him. Like, you know, you were afraid because of the clay thing, and then you've learned you've learned from your losses and to go on. And you were cynically looking at him and finding ways to beat him. You didn't want to draw with him.
That just struck me as being a little bit too much playing. He's so media savvy, Roger Federer. He could be one of the most media savvy performers ever. I think he's aware of what people think of him and how we're talking about him right now, and I think he's happy to...
I think he plays this like a fiddle, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I mean, as you're watching it, I mean, my reaction as well is like, the guy is just unbelievably classy. And actually, it was only afterwards when I saw it in print, I was like, wow, why was I buying this? It's ridiculous.
You're definitely smiling when he's saying it, and in the back of your head you're like, that's actually why I like Serena as well. She's a bit more refreshing, like, especially as a sportswoman. Like, you know, she does things that are like smashing the racket or making the journalist apologise to her last week when he said that she hadn't had the best game and things like that. And some people don't like that and they think it's not classy or, you know, should be above that. But, you know, we celebrate it. Some people we celebrate it in Roy Keane or whoever else. So
yeah,
I'm like,
it's an interesting point, Serena. Sorry to cut across the end of that point, but I think you never know what she's going to say. She's a different communicator in that way. With Federer, you kind of have an idea what's going to come out of his mouth before it does. And Serena, that's definitely not the case.
No, you don't know which one you're going to get, and that's like. Yeah, interesting.
Well, yeah, and I think as well that it goes to the central point. I mean, Roger Federer is a white male tennis player with unbelievable amounts of success. You know, handsome, loved by men, loved by women. I mean, he's coming at this from pretty much diametrically opposed to Serena. Every single media engagement. I mean, Roger Federer, the world has for 20,000 years conspired to ensure that people like Roger Federer get on in life. And Serena,
he still had to do a lot of work.
Well, of course.
Just coast to 18 Grand Slam titles.
Obviously. But I mean, I'm talking about it from the point of view of his interactions with the media and his interactions with his fans. I mean, he's a brilliant tennis player. He has nothing to worry about except his tennis. Whereas if you analyse where Serena Williams has to come from, what Serena Williams has battled to get to where she is, I mean, I think it's only natural that the two of them are, you know, night and day when it comes to, you know, how they deal with media, how they deal with, you know, with obstacles put in their way in life and in tennis.
There's a brilliant ESPN documentary or interview that they did with Serena last year. It was with the rapper Common. It's called The Undefeated in Depth. And it's basically half an hour of Serena talking about the obstacles that she has had to overcome, mostly in terms of her gender and her race. And, you know, you're never going to see Roger Federer having to do a 30-minute, tell-all interview like that. But it's a really interesting watch, just to put her achievement in perspective.
Well, he could talk for 30 minutes about how he's had to improve his backhand to deal with Rafael Nadal over the years. Everybody has their own cross to bear. Just a last one on that. Serena's in this really strong position now and will be for the rest of her life, really, as an incredibly famous sportswoman, sports person, who has taken on some social causes over the years. I'd be interested to see how she uses that. Now, for example, she hasn't spoken about Trump, as far as I know. She was asked about Trump last week. Is there, in this new era where sports people do actually speak out quite a lot, we're doing a piece a bit later on about the US men's soccer captain who spoke out over the weekend about, should we expect somebody like Serena to have a strong opinion and to voice a strong opinion on Donald Trump? Is that expecting too much of a sports person that they have to tell us what they actually think about everything?
Yeah, I don't think that there's a thing that they should have to, or that it's a prerequisite just because you're in the public eye that you must. But I think with her, she will feel like a leader, I think. And I think in some way, some people will feel that is thrust upon them because they have been, lucky is the wrong word, but because she is now living the life she does have. And I think because she does talk about the racism and the sexism that she faced, she will feel like a black woman being looked up to by people. So I think I wouldn't be surprised that she would use her voice. And she talks about that, being able to use her voice for social issues. And I think a couple of people were asking her in press conferences last week about, you know, if Twitter was around years ago, would she have followed different tennis players? And she said she would have. So I think she's very conscious that there are people out there who listen to her and look up to her. I think that's probably the same across the board. But when you are one of very few black women who are as well known as she is, that becomes even more powerful.
Be interesting to see what she does after her career. I'm probably writing the obituary a bit early. She's got about four or five at least more.
She's taken pre-med courses. She's a qualified nail technician. She's fluent in French.
Yeah, she has her own jewellery line. She's been doing
she's going to be okay.
I also don't think she's going to be quitting anytime soon. Like, who's going to, like, this year, who's going to stop her?
Would you put a number on it? How many Grand Slams she gets? There's always the danger now that she's one behind the all-time record, albeit the all-time record with the open era and the pre-open era taken into account, that you can suddenly falter a little bit, even somebody as mentally as strong as Serena.
She's got a few other records to chase, though. So she regains her number one world ranking again today. So currently she's still behind Graf and Navratilova in terms of the amount of weeks that they've held the number one position. And she's also chasing the calendar years, or the Grand Slam as well, to do the four. She's done the four of them, held them all consecutively, but not the same way that Steffi Graf has.
I'd love to see them both at Wimbledon.
Yeah,
that would be good.
Be nice.
Venus
at
Wimbledon playing well, injury free.
We could be getting greedy after the last 2 weeks, to be fair, of tennis that we've seen. We're not probably going to get a tournament with as many storylines as we got in the last 2 weeks. We'd be doing well to see another one in the next.
Thanks, Murph. Finally, we have some good news to talk about, and you drag it right down. Sinead O'Carroll, Elaine Buckley, brilliant stuff. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies.
Serena Williams.
You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I rise. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides. Just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weaned by my soulful cries? Out of the huts of history's shame I rise, up from a past that's rooted in pain I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of a slave. I rise. I rise. I rise.
Yeah, beautiful stuff there by Serena, reading I Will Rise by Maya Angelou last year. That was on the BBC, before the
women's final. Amazing.
The more I think about this, the more the sporting weekend was defined by friendly rivalries and gracious post-match speeches. Both the tennis finals, as we discussed, everyone being very nice. Either Frampton and Santa Cruz, whatever about being nice after a tennis match, these two boys were hugging each other before the final round of a fight where they're punching each other in the head repeatedly, which is sort of an interesting it's an interesting way of shelving your emotions, the anger that you need for the subsequent 3 minutes, just getting that hug in before. The trilogy was already being talked up as the fight was going on, actually. Frampton says Santa Cruz has promised them that they can do it in Belfast. I don't see why Santa Cruz would actually do that. Well, I do see one reason. Could be a lot of money if that's the case, but McGuigan will have a lot of work to do. Barry McGuigan will have a lot of work to do to make that fight work and for Santa Cruz to give up the advantage of being in Vegas. Well, Vegas was, good stuff from both sets of fans, but I don't know how many of his support would be able to procure tickets for the Belfast fight. There's also fever speculation around another fight. Again, Floyd Mayweather appeared at the Frampton Santa Cruz bout. He spoke on Sky Sports. Says that Conor McGregor, the fight is likely to happen. I believe I can get my number, he says. His number being the amount of money that he would need to step into the ring and punch Conor McGregor around for a few rounds.
Yeah.
I've scoffed at this notion of this fight ever happening up until now, and I will continue to scoff until it actually happens, but seeing as everybody else is talking about it, might as well ask you what you think.
Well, you might scoff, Alan. Actually, I'm kind of scoffing as well. Everyone is either scoffing or wants to see this freak show. And that's why... if they were to do it, lots of people would pay to see it. Therefore, there will be a big pot of money, and it's a question of deciding how that's going to be divided. Conor McGregor is quite undiscriminating when it comes to how he makes his money. I mean, he did a big event. I don't know if you saw any of this. So he did this live show in Manchester with, sort of 5,000 people, himself and Ariel Helwani, the celebrity interviewer. Ariel Helwani, obviously the respected MMA journalist, but he came over to Manchester to interview Conor McGregor on stage in front of this huge crowd of people, kind of a Rolls Royce in the back, just behind the couches, in with all this dry ice and sort of spotlights and stuff showing the Rolls Royce, and apparently 5,000 Conor McGregor fans, all of whom had dressed up for the occasion. It was obviously like a quite exacting dress code, so they were all wearing sort of suits and waistcoats and nice shirts, and it kind of looked like a massive alt-right rally. They were all dressed in that sort of... Yeah. Just that well tailored look of the of
well,
the,
it's the woolen waistcoats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, there was a few of those. But so it was like an hour or slightly over an hour of McGregor talking to Helwani, and a lot of it was about Floyd Mayweather. A lot of it was about other things. He says at one point he's talking about various kind of extracurricular activities that he has been doing, or offers that he'd had. he mentioned, for instance, he was invited to do the Predator movie. There's a new Predator movie. I think he said Predator, but he couldn't do it because it was like 8 weeks of a commitment. Whereas he said, "Did you see that horse thing I did?" And it was like, yeah, you know, if you've seen, he did these ads for like the Pegasus World Cup or something, right, whatever that is. Well, I think that was what it was called. Anyway, and he said, with that, he said, I got the contract. I just like went straight to the number and signed, you know, 3 days work for a lot of money. I just signed immediately. I was like, yeah, absolutely. So he is quite undiscriminating in the sense that he's not, you know, if he thinks he's getting well rewarded for what he's doing, he doesn't really think about too many other aspects of it. He talked a lot about the law of attraction this time. He was asked also questions from the audience, and he restated his belief that this really does work. The idea of visualizing where he was going to be, you know, I'd visualized me there with my two belts and now I've made it reality. This thing really works. And which I guess is a way of describing kind of goal-oriented behavior. I suppose, you know, people are always saying you should set goals, and if you do, then the chances that you might fulfill, that you might reach those goals is increased. Mm-hmm. At least you've got an idea of what you're working towards. So I was wondering, well, what is his next thing? And obviously his next thing, you know, once you've visualized all the things, so you've kind of, you've now achieved your dream. So what do you now do? You know, it's kind of another difficult, what's the next thing going to be? And obviously the next thing is fighting Floyd Mayweather, because this is an opportunity, at least he sees it as an opportunity, to make a really, really gigantic sum of money. Huge. I mean, as he was saying, you know, did Floyd offered $15 million, then Dana White offered $25 million. I'm just sitting there at home watching the millions go up, you know. Whatever the deal would be, it would all depend, I suppose, on how many pay-per-views were sold, and then the split between Mayweather and McGregor, whether it would be 50-50, 60-40, 80-20, who knows what it would be.
But that's the thing. Would either of those men, who are both quite motivated by money, be willing to accept less than the other man? Floyd says he has his number. He said, I don't know what Conor's number is. I'd be surprised if he didn't know what Conor's number is or what number might be required.
Mm.
And I'd be equally surprised if Conor's number was to creep above Floyd's number, if Floyd was still so keen on the idea.
Well, you think Mayweather certainly would see himself as being the A-list, the A-list combatant. You know, that McGregor is like a mouthy, a yappy challenger to him. Floyd Mayweather, the undefeated, great, the greatest boxing champion and so on. He would probably think of himself as being the guy who should get more. McGregor's negotiation, or his kind of bargaining chip, appears to be that this is one of the things he mentioned anyway, which is that everyone wants to fight me. I'm the one who has the options. If Floyd doesn't want to fight me, I can fight Manny Pacquiao or, you know, whoever. Or he kind of listed off all the various sports or whatever. He doesn't care. You know, it's just whatever. It's just another day in the office. You know, whoever they have me fighting, you know, like a Jaguar.
Secretariat, you know.
Yeah.
Secretariat wants to get in the ring with me, then bring it on, I say. You know?
So he said he's kind of given it the impression, well, I'm the only person who has the choice of different people to fight, whereas any other of these guys, the only way they can make a super fight with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to be split between fighters is by fighting me. Mm. I mean, he does seem, I think, there was one point where he was talking about the other fighters in the UFC, and he was very uncomplimentary. I mean, you know.
Well, that's hardly anything new.
Yeah, but it was so extreme, almost, what he was saying about them, that, for instance, remember we had Dave Hannigan on a little while ago, and you know, he was giving a kind of critical account of how, you know, his opinion of the UFC. He didn't hold it in very high regard. You know, when you think about it as a sporting competition, I mean, how high level are these athletes really?
Mm.
You know, are we looking here at real high level warriors who could succeed in a range of sports, or are we looking at the guys who weren't good enough to be boxers and weren't good enough to do various other things? And the kind of, well, if you listen to Conor McGregor, that's very much what we're looking at, because the other people in it are effectively, you know, worthless. I mean, the thing is that it's not like he's consistent in what he says. You know, it's not like he sticks to one particular line, because he will then sometimes talk when he wants to praise an opponent, he'll speak really respectful about them. I mean, it's kind of what makes him interesting in a way. When you watch this, a performance like this, which is like a stunning display of bombast and grandiosity, you know, like a lunatic, a crazy, like what is this nonsense? But then punctuated by these moments of kind of extreme charm, you know, where he stops like screaming about what a pussy Floyd Mayweather is or something. And then you can actually suddenly see this like kind of almost disbelief that he has at how everything is going in his life. You know, he's kind of like, he's got this sort of enthusiasm, which is quite charming. You know what I mean? Even if you sort of dislike his attitude, he talked a lot about like, people are always looking for handouts. You know, like, why do I not feel any responsibility towards generally improving the conditions for fighters in this sport? Oh, people are always looking for handouts. You know, a lot of kind of Thatcherite type stuff. It's, you know, it's confusing. It's difficult to sum him up.
Yeah, it is. Well, we'll see what happens with the Mayweather idea. But we're going to head now to chat to New York to chat to Dave Hannigan. We're not talking about UFC this time, Dave. We are talking about what's been going on over the last couple of days. I mean, you've been living in New York for a long time now. Have you ever seen anything like the last couple of days?
I haven't really. I haven't seen anything quite as, you know, the response, the spontaneous response from so many thousands of people. I mean, the scenes at JFK on Saturday were pretty remarkable, partly because, I mean, you know, this sounds kind of stupid, but JFK is a very difficult place to get to. To go to JFK to protest, you really got to commit to the protest.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a protest in downtown Manhattan. For so many thousands of people to turn up there in this impromptu kind of show of defiance and anger about what was happening, I thought that was just remarkable. And then obviously those scenes have been replicated at airports all over the country. So, that has been incredibly positive, and that has been something that I haven't seen anything as organic as that in the 17 years that I've lived here.
There is something heartwarming about it, I guess. You know, there's an argument that it takes the edge somewhat off the reality of what's going on. But maybe, I don't know, maybe that's even a ridiculous thing to say. Like this banning order that's in place now is it's along the lines of what he said he was going to do pre-election. Now he's doing it, but the reality of it, I guess, all the words probably can't prepare you for the reality of something like this being put in place.
Yes, but, you know, I mean, you touched upon it yourself. Like, we forget there's a kind of, you know, I obviously have a foot in kind of in two countries, so I'm following the Irish response and the Twitter response, if you like, and the social media. But you forget there are many, many Americans who, this is why they voted for him. This is what they wanted. It's not like, oh, he's done something that's shocked us. No, they're like, good. This is, you know, you have to listen to talk, right-wing talk radio over here. And, you know, as somebody who lives here, I dip in and out of it because I think it's essential that you know, you know, the way people are thinking. And they are exultant at this. They think it's fantastic. They think the protests are George Soros-funded conspiracies put together by George Soros to undermine the regime. You know, you could not believe the divide that exists here now, and how happy so many people are with this order, which may be shocking to people in Ireland. I hope it's shocking to people in Ireland, but it actually is exactly what they wanted.
Dave, I wonder, is there much overlap between the kind of right-wing talk radio you're talking about and sports talk radio, which is obviously huge in the United States? Do they ever kind of dip their foot in this area, or is it something they very carefully stay away from?
Oh, we've had, there's been a little bit of crossover. I mean, New York sports talk radio, WFAN, would be the biggest, one of the original sports talk radio stations, and I think, you know, the most famous in the U.S., and after 9/11, there was an unbelievably bizarre conversation in which they wanted Israeli citizens to take a loyalty test. And when this was latched onto by the media, the tapes of the conversation went missing. And that's kind of, you know, so every now and again they dip into it. But look, I've listened to a lot of sports talk radio during the election. A lot of people were for Trump. A lot of people saw him as a breath of fresh air, and, you know, he was going to drain the swamp, to use the cliche. So, yes, there was a little bit of a crossover. And then when you get into the athletic world, the sports world itself, the athletes, you know, depending on your sport, you have athletes who despise Trump and everything he stands for. But you have athletes out there probably keeping their heads down right now who are fans of his.
Tom Brady being one of them. We don't know if Brady is going to be asked whether, would you expect him to be asked on Media Day much about his friendship with Trump?
he has to be asked. I mean, the Super Bowl is Sunday. Brady has to be asked about that. And Belichick, the Patriots coach as well, they should be asked. They should have their feet held to the fire on this score. And, you know, I would not be surprised if there is some sort of massive protest in Houston next Sunday night, because, look, the Super Bowl, as you guys know, is the one moment that brings America together. You know, America literally stops on that Sunday night to watch the game and you know, to be involved in that game. Even if you have only a passing interest in sport, you will. The Super Bowl is a social event that kind of stops America in its tracks. So I would expect something to happen in and around the Super Bowl in terms of protest and maybe disruption.
We read out some of what Michael Bradley had to say earlier on, Dave, and it seems it's very strong stuff, very negative towards Trump and what he's done over the last couple of days. He is the men's team captain, the US men's soccer team captain. Is that getting much traction? Do people, is he a big enough personality in American sport, being outside of major sports?
He's not really, you know, he's not a big enough personality. Like, what you need here is you need LeBron James, you need a Tom Brady, you need, you know, like a major baseball player. You need somebody, you know, one of these bigger, you know, bigger stars to come out. And I would expect, you know, the NBA players were very vocal about the Black Lives Matter stuff. And they've been very good in terms of calling out injustice where they see it. So I would be very surprised if the NBA didn't do so, and the NBA players didn't start speaking out individually or collectively. But again, you know, like, the point to remember is lots of people out there, you know, in the golf world, loads of, you know, they've been in bed with Trump for years, and you know, lots of people there, you know, are probably very, very, you know, very supportive of Trump. So, you know, their sport, I guess, reflects the divide within America.
Yeah, I mean, Steve Kerr is the Golden State Warriors coach. He's had a lot to say. I mean, he's always criticizing Trump. And I guess he's a pretty major figure in basketball. But where does that come from, do you think, that divide? I mean, how would you categorize the different sports? What makes the difference between basketball, where a lot of people seem to be willing to speak out or seem to have problems with what's happening, and other sports like golf, football, baseball, maybe?
Well, I think with football or with basketball, the players have so much power and they're so safe. You know, they're not endangering their livelihoods. You know, they're almost untouchable. You know, you understand what I mean? Like Carmelo Anthony with the Knicks and LeBron James. These guys are bigger than their sport almost, and they can speak out without fear of reproach. In other sports, you know, the equivalent, I suppose, is Brady in football. But Brady's a fan of Trump. You know, and in locker rooms, I would guess the divide is where you come from. You know, people who come from the states and the counties within those states that voted for Trump, which, you know, many Midwestern and Southern states, et cetera, are probably Trump supporters. And, you know, that's a generalization, but I think that's the way it divides. I'm sure there's a ethnic divide as well, you know, in terms of racial identity. Absolutely. You know, I mean, it, just like there is in the wider country. But just to go back to the Bradley stuff, is, you know, this was a very brave move for Bradley, because, you know, he is now kind of stuck his head above the parapet, and he's not as untouchable as the guys that I mentioned. You know, he is not, you know, beyond reproach and, you know, independently wealthy and far bigger than the sport, etc.
Just lastly, Dave, the IOC, Ian Herbert had a piece in this in The Independent today. The IOC's silence on Trump is contemptible. No way should Los Angeles now host the 2024 Olympics. And he's making the point that the IOC says it does not comment on the politics of sovereign countries. I'm sure you haven't had a chance to read this yet. We're talking to you very early on, very early American time. But as an idea, is it a bit optimistic hoping for an organization like the IOC to be the ones leading the charge on this one?
Yeah. The IOC, if we're looking for moral guidance from the IOC, we're even in worse trouble than we think we are. But again, look, the Los Angeles badly wants the games. If you're looking, you know, to hurt America or make America understand the hurt that's out there in the rest of the world about this, this would be the perfect way to do it. But again, if we could rely on the IOC for that, you know, I think that's rather optimistic. But certainly in terms of, you know, box office events, the Los Angeles wants the games, and this is a way of you know, hitting America economically and in terms of, you know, a glamour event, if the Olympics is still that, taking it away from it. But, you know, Trump you know, Trump, what does Trump care? That's 8 years down the line, you know, or 7 years down the line, whatever it is. That's a long way away for him.
All right, listen, Dave Hannigan, always good to catch up. Thanks a million.
Cheers, guys. Thanks.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Richie Sadler's here. Richie, how are you?
How are you, lads?
How are you, lads?
Richie,
how are you, lads?
How are you doing this week?
I'm marvellous.
Look at the joy on my face. Look how happy I was. What the fuck happened? No, really. You know, what happened?
When John was young, everyone in the city knew about it, but no one had seen him.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's persuaded of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Steve Kerr was an interesting one to bring up, Ken. We've mentioned him a couple of times since the Trump, since the election. He spoke around the time of the election as well. He's talking again now. Greg Popovich is another one, actually. But in the case of Kerr, I mean, his background is fascinating. I don't know if you've talked to US Murph much about him. We've talked a bit about him on air, but had a chat when Brian was over for the show late last year, and he put me onto an interview that David Axelrod had done, you know, the former Obama advisor. He's got a podcast called The Axe Files.
Oh, yeah.
And he interviewed Steve Kerr. Like, really fascinating life. Kerr was born in Beirut. Mm. His dad traveled around a lot there. He's like an academic. Steve Kerr spent a lot of his time in his early years in Beirut, in Egypt, in all sorts of places in that part of the world. So he's a very different idea on what the world is to maybe your average American, let alone your average Trump supporter.
Yeah.
His dad was ultimately murdered I think he was 52 years of age. He was working at that stage as president of the American University of Beirut. And he was, I don't know, would you call it an assassination when it's an academic like that? But he was killed by terrorists. So of all the people to have an opinion, and you know, when you're questioning the motives of a lot of people or questioning their belief system, where does this actually come from? Do you believe in what you're saying? I think Steve Kerr's got a pretty good grasp of the world and how it works. Definitely recommend that interview as well with David Axelrod. That's called The Axe Files. If you get a chance to listen to that.
The whole thing is just so overwhelmingly stupid that it's difficult to believe that this is really happening for the reasons they say it's happening. Hmm. You know, the idea that the threat of terrorist attacks has something to do with the border security or the people that you let into the country is just so crazy. Like, it's, you know, I have a feeling that, you know, people who want to carry out that kind of attack are going to find a way to be able to do that, are going to find a way to be able to get into the United States. It's not the most difficult thing anyone's ever undertaken. You know what I mean? There are more complicated things to do than get into this vast country with tens of thousands of miles of borders. The idea, this is just penalizing everybody. It's not going to solve the problem. I mean, the problem is, if people have this idea that they want to do it, where does the willingness to do that come from? I mean, that's like a thing that exists in people's heads. I mean, that's the problem. The idea that you can, you know, by banning a lot of people from coming into the country, you can do something about that. It's just totally insane. It's so stupid that I can't believe they really think it's going to work. I wonder why they're actually doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you have to remember, like, the Eric, wasn't it Eric? One of the sons, anyway, tweeted the Skittles photograph. You know, if you were given a bowl of Skittles with 10,000 Skittles in it, and you were told that three or four of them were poisonous, would you? Why would you take the risk, effectively, of letting in 10,000 or 100,000 or 1 million refugees if you thought that three or four of them were capable of doing damage to the United States? I mean, at the time, the idea that you would a rational human being could make an argument that stupid, that inhumane, it's so bizarre. And yet, within a week, we've gotten to that stage where it's actual American foreign policy or domestic. Or is it foreign policy or is it domestic policy? Either way, it's some of the most shocking things I think any of us have ever seen. If we all live to be 100, I don't think we'll ever experience the last 10 days like we've just had.
I hope you're right.
In August last year, the then Olympic Council of Ireland president Pat Hickey seemed to be fairly sure of what was going to happen once his long stint had been completed. You might remember him anointing Willie O'Brien initially. Our understanding of it is that Willie O'Brien, who is the first vice president at the time, will do a stint up until Tokyo. And then the favourite at the moment to take over from him is John Delaney. So there's been a bit of water under the bridge since those comments were made only a few short months ago. Delaney's finished with the OCI entirely. He explained his decision in a statement that downplayed his role in the organisation.
He didn't do anything, but he doesn't have the time to
continue to do that, very little, yeah. But Willie O'Brien, who served as vice president, as I mentioned, Dickie, he's still trucking on. He's been acting as president since the scandal broke in Rio, and he's one of three people now going for the big gig for real. A couple of days ago, he was interviewed by Joanne Cantwell in RT's Saturday Sport so that he could state his case for the job, set out his vision, and answer a few questions, some of them quite tough. Not sure he fully grasped his opportunity. We'll play you a couple of clips here. This, the background to this first one is that there was an independent review, you probably remember this, by Deloitte, which took place after the ticketing scandal. It suggested a number of changes in governance the OCI should implement. So he assured Cantwell that he would be willing to make sure each of the 25 recommendations is provided for. That was a phrase he used in the lead up to this clip. She pointed out that one of the recommendations, though, is that there are time limits for all executive members, that nobody serves for more than 12 years. And he's already served 20 years. So how is he going to implement all these policies if one of the policies would mean that he can't be the president and can't be involved anymore? So that's the background to this exchange.
We have to look at that independent knowledge. We have to see how best it fits in to the framework of the Olympic Council going forward. What's best for the organisation? What's best to produce the best results for the athletes? And if it is two terms, I'm happy that it will be changed to two terms.
But that's not what they say. They say 12 years. And you've already been 20 years.
But I explained to you, I've been 20 years at different
but
roles.
But that's not what it says. It doesn't say within different roles. It says just as a committee member.
Again, it's a recommendation.
But you said you were going to implement all the recommendations. You said there were 25 recommendations and you would implement them.
We will implement them.
But not that one that would stop
you. We will implement that one. We will implement it when it's discussed and the recommendations are looked at, and we will implement that recommendation.
But if you implement it, does that not rule you out then of going for the presidency?
Well, it will have to be implemented in line with the structure of the Olympic Council. You have committee members that come in with no experience. You then have the officer board of the council, and then you have the president's role and the secretary general's role. In the IOC terms, the president's role and the secretary general's role are the two most important terms. Everything in IOC terms is dealt through the president and the secretary general.
But can you not understand, though, the point I am making here?
I do understand the point you're getting.
So, but you're saying you're going to implement them, but at the same time you're saying, well, only if we discuss them and then we won't implement them. Because if you're implementing them, then...
We will implement them.
But you will remain on for longer than the recommended 12 years.
These are recommendations that have come in today. In order to implement them, I have to stay on and work on implementing
them. Sound like we could have gone on for another 10 minutes there and he wasn't going to fully... Well, the answer to the question is, if you're implementing them, then you can't be there to implement them.
There is sometimes when you think that there's obfuscation going on, and then sometimes you're listening to something and you think, the two people involved here are coming at, there are different levels of understanding of what's being discussed there.
I'd say it's obfuscation, though. I'm sure he said he understood the point that she was raising.
Yeah.
But clearly he wants to be the president, so he can't implement that one if he wants to be president. So he's got to find a way to talk himself around that, which he didn't do very well. Like, these interviews can be sometimes a bit soft-focused. I mean, these sort of candidate sets out their vision for their sport kind of interviews, because by their nature, they haven't done anything yet. You're waiting to see what they're going to tell you, all these great things that they're doing, and then you maybe pick some holes in that. In this case, he was part of a previous regime which blew up in flames in Rio, so he must have expected some of these tricky questions and didn't really have very coherent answers for them.
Yeah, Joanne asked him about flying business.
Sorry, I'm cutting across here, but we're going to take that little clip.
As president, will you travel first class?
No.
Have you travelled first class in your time with the OCI?
I have travelled first class, yeah.
Often, while athletes... Travelled economy?
No, never while at least travel economy.
How did you go to Rio?
I went to Rio for business class.
Business class, but the athletes travelled first class or economy, did they?
The athletes travelled economy, yeah.
Is that something you will intend to continue, or will you travel the same way the athletes do?
No, I didn't travel with the athletes. I traveled separately.
No, I know that. But if they are traveling economy, do you think it is right that a member of the OCI travels in business class?
I believe that everybody on a long-haul trip like Rio, everybody should travel business class. Unfortunately, it's such an expensive commodity that the OCI couldn't afford that.
But they could afford it for members of the OCI?
They could afford it for them, I admit to that.
Okay, Willie O'Brien, the very best of luck with your election. Thank you very much for coming into us.
Thank you.
Do you know how much it costs to fly these athletes business class? I mean, it's unbelievable. Do you know how expensive these tickets are?
Oh, that's very funny, isn't it? Oh, God, it must be so annoying being in the OCI and having to, you know, suddenly I have to be ashamed of all the perks of the job. You know, what's with this new Puritanism?
Time was you could just go about your business, you know?
Yeah.
And now you're going to have to sit here and answer these questions.
He told Joanne Cantwell afterwards that he only has been on business class 5 times in the 20 years. Mm. That was a clarification. Well, it wasn't even a clarification because he didn't give any other number at that stage.
Yeah. Has he not been travelling much or what?
Now he wants to be president.
Five business class.
Is there a distinction between business class and first class? Because he did seem to make that distinction in his own statement.
But isn't first class even...
business class.
Oh, yeah.
I think first class is probably
first class is
higher,
first class. Yeah, no, first class is the top notch.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure, Ken, what differences there are.
Different airlines call it different things.
Oh, is that just it? There's not first and business on the same flight.
Well, there's different levels of stratification depending on which airline you want to travel.
Surely you just go left or you go right. I mean, I think that's the level of stratification we're talking about.
There's a man who's only ever travelled economy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably best you don't listen to this next bit. But Owen, actually, in some airlines, there are super classes beyond even business class, yeah.
Oh, stop. I mean, I'm 5'10". I need those first class seats, Ken. Stretch these legs out. I'm never out of first class.
I've never flown business class. One of the great regrets of my life. Mm. Business or any higher level. Never.
Of course, Jerry Seinfeld believes that you should never fly business class.
Because it ruins.
Unless you intend flying business class for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
I think that there's probably a lot of sense to that.
I think I am probably on board with that because, I mean, okay, flying economy class, especially if it's a long flight, can be a little bit annoying, but it's usually okay, right? I mean, what's the worst thing to happen? Deep vein thrombosis?
Yeah, as long as you don't ever see how the other half flies, is what you're saying.
It's probably for the best. I mean, I can't, you need someone else to pay for you if, you know, like someone like the OCI or whatever. If you're going to fly business class, it is insanely expensive. So either you're loaded or someone else is paying the bill. And I've never been fortunate enough to be in that position. Maybe one of these days, although maybe, as you say, it would be the ruination of my, you know...
in-flight experience.
The OCI will hold their meeting on all of that in early February, by the way. Sarah Keane from Swim Ireland and Bernard O'Byrne, the former FAI CEO, he's now the head of Basketball Ireland. He was quite vocal in the aftermath of everything that happened in Rio. They're the other two candidates for that one. Oh, the Irish Times Second Comes Football Podcast. Where are my manners?
That's... Yeah... They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Well, when we started off talking about the FA Cup, and within about 45 seconds, you were talking about US Ryder Cup teams of days gone by. We returned to the subject of the FA Cup for a while and talked about why it's not that interesting anymore.
We're explaining to you why you shouldn't be interested in the topic that we're talking about.
Why you aren't interested. I mean, because the fact is that you're probably not. And why is that?
We have an interesting conversation about why you're not interested.
Let's drill down into that, as they say. Mm. So we drilled, we did a bit of drilling.
A lot of drilling. Yeah. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, all. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening.
Whose phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.